Welcome to Go For Septic. I'm your host, Shayna Worsham, and today we have a very exciting guest that I'm so glad to have met. Her name is Sally Ledger, and to give you a teeny tiny background on her, she has worked on Mary Poppins Returns, Lady and the Tramp, and she also actually had started on Wicked, but they had moved production, so she unfortunately won't be finishing that show. And she also did Spider-Man, just to name a couple. She's going to share with us some insight about what the art director role is and how they work with other departments and just talk about a little of everything. She was a little nervous to do this, and I'm so grateful that I talked her into it, because I know sometimes we are very shy when it comes to doing anything that is perceived as in front of the camera, because we're all behind the scenes people. We would much rather stay in our comfort zone, which is not doing things like this. So I can't express how much I'm grateful for her doing this episode. So Sally is an art director, and she's going to talk about a couple of things with the art department and a couple of things with some stories on set. And another thing that we had just talked about after we stopped recording was we wanted to congratulate Sarah Riney, who also did our buyer episode, on her new role that she just got elected for as vice president of 479, our union in Georgia. So she just got that new position, and we're very excited for her. And I also want to congratulate Abby Hilton, who was elected as our new general secretary / treasurer, and Paige Jarvis was also elected as the labor delegate to the AFL/CIO. And I just wanted to start off and say congratulations. And Sally wanted to express her congratulations to Sarah as well. We're very excited to see some new faces in the 479 league, and we hope to work with them in the future on some stuff. And I'm just really excited for Sarah, and I know Sally is too. I'm going to stop carrying on, but very, very fun things coming. I hope to finish up these next couple episodes and get these people in for interviews that I have scheduled. And just a little insight, I'm not going to be doing a weekly release of episodes, just because it has been a little more challenging to get our schedules aligned with some of the guests. So in case you see holes in the schedule of the episode's releasement, it's like refreshment, but release dates, the releases on the episodes, is just because my schedule's been a little hectic, and making sure I get everyone scheduled at the right time has also been a little crazy. So yeah, so enjoy Sally and all of her insights. Thank you so much, Sally, for doing this and coming on. I know that you were a little apprehensive at first about doing an episode about art directors, but I really appreciate you being here, and I'm excited to hear all of your pretentious, non-pretentious answers for these questions.
I'm excited too. Yeah, get ready for some pretentious answers for sure.
Bring it on. We love a little pretentious. I'm here for the bougie side of things. I want all of it. I'm very excited. A helping of bougie, a helping of British. It's very exciting to me.
Yeah. Okay. Let's do this.
All right. How would you describe the art director's job and responsibilities, which I know is a giant question?
So no pressure. Yeah, I mean, it is a big question, and I'm going to start off straight away with a pretentious quote from very well-known art director and designer Thomas Walsh. And he said, "To be a narrative designer is to be an architect of dreams, a purveyor of wonderment." And I guess, to put it simply, art directors are like the second hands of the production designer. We help their vision come to life, and we are the architects behind the sets you see on screen. So everything within the frame on your TV or at a cinema has been intentionally and thoughtfully placed there by the production designer and their art department. And I guess all of our jobs is the art of using design to facilitate good storytelling. And then not only do art directors help set the artistic tone from the very first meeting with the director, but we manage the workflow of the art department, and that's with illustrators, set designers, graphic artists, and we develop concepts and various layouts from the very first conceptual sketch all the way to creating blueprints for builds. We aid in the selection of locations, we supervise construction and scenic painting, all the way through to selecting materials and finishes. And the spaces we create are the very bones of the story. So I like to think we're like architects. And I mean, it can be anything from like building ancient Greece with a few columns to a sleek linear design and you're suddenly inside a spaceship. It's exactly. It's the framework of reality that we're creating, you know. Right. And I think that's why I find it so fascinating, because I've always wanted to be part of that world in creating the bones and the place, the belonging, that sense of belonging for the character.
You're in the thick of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that that
kind of sums it up. I need a little bit
beautiful.
Of
teaching in there. I love it. What are some of the roles in the art department that the art director normally works with? Like, it could be the PA, the designer, construction.
So I guess I'll go through our structure in the art department, and that's production designer, art directors, assistant art directors, set designers, illustrators, graphic designers, art department coordinators, and PAs. So it can be quite a large department, and depending on the size of project you're on, that can range from like 40 to 50 people, mm-hmm. all the way down to a smaller show that could be made up of 3 people. It just depends on the scope of the project, really. And then outside of the art department, we have a lot to do with the director and DP, as well as construction. You know, we conceptualize all the way through to the building process, mm-hmm. much like a project manager would in an architectural firm. And then simultaneously, we're working with other departments, mm-hmm. for example, like stunts, who might have a certain requirement of the set, or special effects. We might need to design a special rig for them. We have a lot to do with picture cars. There seems to always be designing vehicles within films and TV shows. So virtually anything you would see on screen, we would want the production designer to ultimately approve and it be their vision.
Right.
So, yeah.
It would have to fit in line with their mm-hmm. their design, which is kind of why they're the boss. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I have a personal question that I wanted to ask that I was hoping you could shed some light on, because on set and when we're doing shows, I'm always like, what is the difference between an art director and an assistant art director, whether it be their responsibilities or the time that you spend in each position? I'm just curious.
So I guess assistant art directors are there to support the art director and the art department in general. Mm-hmm. And they're far more detail driven. So an art director would oversee the larger picture of multiple sets, whereas the assistant art director would be in charge of things like stage plans or director plans, hardware, or aiding in material sourcing and selection. So they hone in on details, okay. whereas the art director might not have as much time for those details. But they work in tandem. And a lot of times assistant art directors can get given their own sets. So they'll art direct 2 or 3 sets out of 12 or something. So they're just as skilled, but they're more there as a support role.
Gotcha.
And eventually then they will step up to art direct all sets.
How long does it normally take to go from an assistant art director into the art director role? I know it's kind of a hard one to answer because everything's so situational, but...
Everybody's trajectory is different. In the UK, you have to, for example, you have to be a PA for 2 years, then you have to be a junior set designer for 2 years. as a set designer for 2 years, and then you become an assistant art director.
Wow.
So it's very structured, whereas here in America it's a bit more loose. And I would say that, you know, you could be flipped into the union and be an art director before and skip the whole assistant art directing.
Oh, wow.
But I think for me it took 5 years of assistant art directing.
Oh, yeah.
And then, and I do think that that has helped me ultimately. Like, without that, I would be more nervous, you know. I think it gave me confidence in art directing to know what I was doing and, you know, how to manage the role. So I'm thankful for doing it for 5 years, but it's different for every person.
Oh, absolutely. Very true. And you've worked on some really big shows. So I feel like that also plays a factor. If you were to do something smaller, I feel like it would be easier to take on a bigger role.
Yeah. I think a lot of people bounce between assistant art directing, maybe on bigger films, and then going to art direct smaller shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think the skill level is comparative. It just depends, what the scale and scope of the show is. But
yeah, that's fair. How would you say the art director's role compares when you're on a movie versus when you're on TV?
So this is a funny one, because I constantly tell people that in my experience, my role is easier on films. And that's purely because of the luxury of time and money. So TV is, as we all know, super fast-paced, cutthroat, and there's no time to get invested or develop an idea. And in a way, I think maybe you do learn more from TV, because you constantly ask yourself, like, what's the best way for me, the most efficient way for me to tell the story? And that leads to reduction in your design. And I actually think that reduction is probably the best form of design. There are no fuss, there's no frills, it's just, you know, story driven. And that's the best way to learn, almost, I think. So though TV is difficult,
it's kind of like the fast food version of the film industry in a sense, because you kind of just gotta, like, let's get through it and it's time to do this, so guess we have to eat. Time for fast food.
And then when you get to the feature film world, you're like, wow, it's like a never-ending banquet, you know. I can just, like, you can really invest and, like, develop your design ideas. Mm-hmm. And that is a luxury, you know, that to have that time to really process it and get it to be the most fantastic version of what you had envisioned.
Right.
So that is a luxury. And I would say working in film has always been my preference, but I do think in my career, I've learned the most on TV. So that's wonderful.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I think when it comes, because for me, it's the same thing. Anytime I do jobs on TV, we definitely have the time restriction. And so you're kind of cutting out big character development things, and you have less time to develop a certain style. So you're just going with something that's more simplistic. And the most that I learned, because I come from the commercial world, I learned more on film just for my position, because I am so used to the fast food version of doing things with music videos and commercials. It's like, hey, well, let's do stylized, let's do expensive looking when it's super cheap. But film really taught me how to develop a character and think like how, if this person has a garage and they're constructing some crazy thing, you would need to practice with test dummies, and you'd have to do, you know, XYZ to figure out this thing that they're building. And my brain didn't really feel natural in that way, because I was like, it doesn't really matter. It needs to just look good on screen for this music video or this commercial, which is backward.
Yeah. So we had opposite experiences, but I think both come into play as far as when you do get to those shows that you're like, gosh, I have to be fast, we're ready for it now, you know, we've been trained to be that way. And when you get to films now, you learn to, like, breathe into the process and be like, okay, I've got a few months here, let's figure out, like, the best way of doing this, like, and practice until we get it, and, you know, perfect. So I think both come into play. It just, again, depends on the type of show you're on.
Yeah, definitely. And I I will always prefer films.
Yeah, me too. I think everybody does. Just the luxury of time and the luxury of the budget too.
Yeah.
You get a lot more in feature film than you would on a TV show, in my experience.
Oh, absolutely. For sure. What are some of the most common challenges for an art director on any show? I know that's a super broad question and kind of a challenging one to answer, but just something that would be kind of more of a common challenge that would carry over into other things.
I think probably learning to work with multiple personalities across the board.
Ooh, you know, good one.
From respecting your director, you know, and their choices that you may sometimes question.
Mm-hmm.
To your DP, who has his own vision of artistically how it might look, which might not always align with your own.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the way through to producers, who might not necessarily fully understand what you do as a department sometimes.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, all the way through to construction, who, you know, I moved to Georgia a few years ago, and hearing my British accent in amongst Georgian accents, it was, you know, a cultural thing to like learn how to communicate clearly with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from both sides, like they didn't understand a word I was saying, and a lot of times, you know, vice versa. But like learning how to communicate with all these different personalities and kind of finding your way.
Mm-hmm.
In ultimately you've all got the same goal, but I think that, and it must be like this in any industry, but the personalities can be quite a challenge.
Oh, yeah. Just the range that you have from perspectives, opinions, upbringings, backgrounds, you name it. It is very diverse, and you have to be a very adaptable person to, I feel like, become successful in your environments.
And what I might think is clear might not necessarily be clear to somebody else, you know, and how they communicate, I have to learn that too.
Oh, absolutely. So,
yeah.
I struggle with that because the buyer decorator position, the relationship between them has to be pretty, like, you have to have a very understood connection and really be able to converse in a way. I'm visual. So for when I decorate, I just give visual references and I explain, mm-hmm. but my words might not be the most eloquent that I'm using to describe this chair that we need, but I'll give you 20 different pictures of versions that we could do or adjust to. And sometimes you have someone that just doesn't get it because their background, when you say modern, means something else.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I think, and we're all quite, I mean, set deck and art department, we are quite visual. So I often think a sketch is the easiest way to communicate almost to anyone, from the director, you know, this is the way I want the room to look.
Right.
To all the way to construction, you're like, this is how I want it to be built. Yeah.
Right.
Providing reference is almost the best way to bypass any miscommunication.
Exactly. Yeah, I feel like a lot of the times you can really go off the rails because how someone interprets what you say could be very different than what you're saying, and that can get skewed quick.
For sure.
What are some of the tools and skills that you need to be an art director?
I would say a strong background in both art and architecture. So kind of touching on what we were just talking about, being able to sketch and rely on visuals, like a quick pencil sketch communicates the most effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'd also say on top of that, being able to draw architectural plans and elevations is what you would really need for the art department.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding scale and how things are built.
Huge.
Yeah, having an eye for both design and function, kind of draws those two things together. And I would say a lot of people tell you, oh, you don't need to know how to do technical drawings, but in my experience, not having those skills translates to a world full of mistakes.
Oh yeah.
And it's better to bypass that and be able to understand technical architectural drawings and to be able to draw them if you need to on the fly to communicate.
Right. And like where we're going with the industry, I feel like that's going to be impossible to get around in the future.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
I always think about how can I avoid, I hate technology. I'm so bad at it. I'm so bad at using it. And so I'm like, how can I avoid doing this on the computer? And then I reassess and I'm like, oh, I guess I'll teach myself this program with this thing and the drawing and importing the photos. And it, in the end, it's going to help me in the future. It's just annoying.
Oh, yeah. Up front. Absolutely. Yeah. We'll get faster at it as we go, I think.
Yeah, exactly. What was the best piece of advice that you got regarding being an art director?
I think owning your mistakes and not blaming others. Our industry seems to be full of a lot of people who will quickly cast judgment and be like, oh, well, they did it wrong. And it's like, as an art director, as I higher up within the art department, your responsibility is your team. Any mistakes that somebody else might make within your team is actually your mistake because you didn't catch it. Mm-hmm. And I don't like the culture of blaming others. I think just as human beings, we often do that because we feel like it's, you know, fight or flight syndrome. But I think owning mistakes is far more powerful, and apologizing and saying, you know, I'm so sorry I missed that, but next time I promise you I'll catch it. And I feel like I have seen my bosses do that, and I have so much respect for that, far more than if I see them cast blame to people that shouldn't be blamed, you know. So
yeah, the accountability thing is huge. I feel like it's, I mean, just like you were saying, it's one of the most rare things in our industry. So it, to me, I also have the highest amount of respect when my bosses and people in the leadership roles have that form of accountability.
Yeah, for sure. So I think having accountability and then in tandem with that, having a paper trail is always a good thing. So if you have an email train or like drawings or director plans or set notes, you can use that to your benefit, and then mistakes hopefully might not happen, and then no blame will have to be shared anyway. So
yeah, I have gotten into really sticky situations that I learned the super hard way, like talking to locations and bringing out all this really expensive silver that the location had. And I double checked with the location rep and just was like, hey, are we going to get charged for these items? Because, you know, we're pulling them out of the actual location and using them, or is this included in our location fee? And this is an in-person conversation. And so when I was told it's part of the location fee, I had nothing paper form to go back on. And so when I got a bill for $50,000 at the end of the show, when we were already over budget, you can imagine like what my entire soul felt like, because I had no paper trail to back it up. And I was like, hey, blank, blank. There's this issue because now I'm getting charged for these items. And remember you told me that it was part of the location fee, and he denied it.
Oh no.
So it was him versus me, and the producer already didn't like me because I threw a fit over a car. So it turned into like a whole situation and back and forth. And
yeah, and just having an email behind you to say, look, here's my receipt of when you said this.
Yeah, it would have cleared up everything. Yeah. You got to cover your bases.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I think it's almost like having a receipt for your own ass, you know?
Yeah. Like having someone, you have this conversation with someone, and then the minute that they say that, just have them send you an email that says it. And if they don't that day, follow up and be like, you need to send me that email that says this thing because you agreed to it and you need to have some kind of formal backup for it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Unfortunately. So one thing, because I'm in SETDEC and our unions operate completely different, can you talk about the Art Directors Union a little bit? Because I know, I just know nothing about it.
So the Art Directors Guild of America is called the Local 800, and it represents four different categories. So you've got number one, production designers, art directors, and assistant art directors. Number two, you've got graphic designers. Number three, illustrators. And number four, set designers. So the first category that I mentioned, production designers and art directors, are represented nationwide, so across America. Whereas sadly, the other three, their jurisdiction is only in California. And it basically means as an art director, I can work anywhere in America. But as a, maybe if I was a set designer, I'd either have to be in LA under the 800, or I'd have to join the local union here in Georgia.
Okay.
And I'd be part of the 479 as a set designer here. So it just depends which route you go within that. I was lucky when I graduated college because I applied for the Art Directors Guild and was awarded it in 2015, which is essentially an apprenticeship built to guide and train young assistant art directors. So I was very lucky that that was my route in, but there are so many routes into the 800. You might be on a show that has flipped union.
Mm-hmm.
You might do the portfolio review, which is when they review all your work and they've seen how much you've worked, you know, on music videos or non-union things, and they decide that you should be part of the union.
Oh.
And then I guess the initiation fees is part of it too. So you have to get in, you have to pay about $10,000,
mm-hmm.
Depending on your technical level. So it would be different if you were a set designer. It might be different if you were an illustrator.
Oh, right.
And then dues, I think for me, are roughly like $500 quarterly.
Oh, okay.
But that means I get my healthcare and my pension plan
right
up to date, and I'm always a member. And I will always be on the list of people working. So if I'm not working, I can let the union know, and then my availability will pop up and somebody from the union will be able to hire me. So it's worth being part of the 800, I think. And then alternatively, you could just move to Georgia, which is a right-to-work state, and flip in as long as you have somebody recommending you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another brilliant way of doing it. If I had known that straight out of school, I would have moved straight to Georgia.
Oh, wow, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, coming from England, I thought all the movies were in
LA.
In LA, so I moved there, but nobody told me that Georgia was a right-to-work state. And you just needed, you know, somebody who was willing to take a chance on you. 30 days later, you'd be in that union. So I wish I'd known that.
Yeah, that it's, I learned about, so number one, just in case anyone doesn't know, when you flip a movie, that basically means you start out on the show as non-union, and then usually transpo or a certain department will advocate for it to get flipped to a union show. And normally they'll backdate your days, so you get a certain amount of days to become a union member. And with the Set Deck 44 local in LA, their books are closed. So the only way to get in is if you flip a show, if you're on a show that flips.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then in contradictory, not contradictory, but on the flip side of things, or I shouldn't say that because that's even more confusing. On the other side of things, we have Georgia, where you can move here or just, you know, be here, and you can get into the union by having certain people that recommend you, and you pay the fees and you're in, and it requires less paperwork or worker hours or anything. It's a much more easier union to get into, just because, yeah, it is a right to work state. So it makes it a little more, the transition is less difficult, less of a challenge, for sure. So normally you work pretty closely with construction, and being in SetDeck, we also kind of work pretty closely with construction, but we have a very different relationship. And I was wondering if you could tell me a story or two of how things have gotten lost in translation, or something that was a huge success, or just something kind of funny, because you work with a whole huge department as well.
I guess I have two stories that have taught me it. You know, two situations that have taught me the most. One, when I was as an assistant art director, and I was actually doing some graphics for Set Deck.
Oh.
And it was pop art pow and wow, you know, those kind of graphics, mm-hmm. to go on ping pong paddles that would be sort of like artwork on the walls.
Okay.
And, you know, I know the size of a ping pong paddle, but, you know, so I scaled it and I was like, okay, I think it would roughly be 6 inches or something. And I remember somebody saying, Sally, have you checked the scale? And I thought to myself, I'm pretty sure a ping pong paddle is not that big, but yeah, I mean, I'll go and check the scale. So I asked someone and I said, what are the dimensions of these ping pong paddles? And they read to me the package dimensions. So I changed my graphic and I blew it up huge. And I, in my head, I was like, this is the size of a tennis racket, but you know, I'm not going to question. I was given these dimensions. I'm not going to question it. I'm just going to go for it.
Right.
And then everyone, when they arrived, everyone was like, what, Sally, what were you thinking? Like, we do not have tennis, you know, tennis rackets that we're hanging up. We're hanging up ping pong paddles.
No.
And that taught me, don't rely on someone else for the dimensions. Mm-hmm. You know, the dimensions that person gave me, and bless them, they didn't know what I was really asking for. They gave me the packaging right. dimensions. They, you know, they're like, I don't know, what do you mean? What are the sizes? You know, I guess ultimately it taught me, go and measure it yourself. You know?
Absolutely.
Make sure you get those measurements. Yeah, and that was like my first project, you know, my first big project in the art department. And I really, it taught me so much. I always think about it now whenever I'm scaling. I'm like, remember that time?
Oh, memories. And ping pong paddles, so we go way back.
Yeah, that was like a funny one that I always try and, I also remind myself, like, at the end of the day, it's not that big of a deal, right? It's not like open heart surgery. It was a little bit of artwork that was going on the wall, and I probably wasted a little bit of money on them, but not the hugest deal,
right?
And then on the, you know, another example could have been catastrophic in that we're responsible for people's safety on set. Absolutely. You know, when we are building big structures, you have a sense of not only the actor's safety, every single person that is walking anywhere near that set, you do have this huge sense of, gosh, if that should fall down. Luckily, nothing ever has in my experience, but there was this one set that we had to build for a show that was quite complex. It was a domed room on top of a special effects gimbal that would move back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the director and DP said, we want every single wall of that set to wild.
Oh, fuck.
And I thought, in what world are they ever going to have time to wild all these walls?
Right.
And shoot 360 from every single section?
Right.
But B, it's hard to explain to people the structural integrity of a dome
mm-hmm.
that is moving, and then you start taking pieces out of that, you know, pie.
Right.
So has anyone ever done this before? Maybe, but not on the show we had been on. So, you know, construction seemed confident, we go ahead with it, and we did a test run and the screws snapped when we started the gimbal of moving it back and forth. And I just went to bed that night and I thought, God, I don't think I would be able to live with myself knowing that happened in the test run, you know?
Right.
How can we solve it? And you also have to keep in mind that art directors, whilst we've been to, you know, some of us might have been to school for architecture and film design, this is structural engineering you're asking us to do, you know? This is like some serious math going on.
Mm-hmm.
As many math equations you can do, you might not get it right. So we had to bring in, you know, an outside third-party engineering company to test this set. And that just, I think that just made me feel a lot better. And you should do that on sets where you're not 100% sure.
Right.
Yeah, that always sticks out to me, is when you've just got so many departments, you know, coming in saying, we need all the walls to wild. We need the whole set to be moving on a gimbal up and down. And you're trying to make it as safe as possible. But sometimes, yeah, you just need that third party as your receipt.
Oh, you know? Absolutely.
This is my receipt of safety. We did it, you know. But I constantly think you could come up against that with a multitude of sets. Like you could be creating a spaceship. You could be creating anything. And yeah, special effects being involved, stunts being involved. Sometimes it just gets so huge and you need multiple eyes on it to make sure it's safe.
Right. Yeah. It's so helpful and it's the safer option.
And it turned out to be a huge success ultimately. I mean, it worked and it was great, but had we not done that test before, we wouldn't have,
gone
ahead,
Absolutely.
I'm thankful for that.
Testing is very essential. I did this movie and it was a Christmas movie and we had blocks and blocks of houses that at the last minute we were going to do Christmas lights on. We always knew originally it was going to be this one block of houses. And of course, like us and our smaller set deck team could handle that. It's a small one block radius that we're doing. And then all of a sudden it turned into three blocks and then it was four and then it was four and a half. And so we had 3 days to put Christmas lights on two story houses, all four and a half blocks. And our set deck team, I think our core crew was three, and it's the lead man, me, and I actually had COVID at the time and didn't know it was COVID. And I had like 102 fever the entire time in the middle of the snowy winter. And so we're out there like dressing all these Christmas decorations in and we're getting the main street ready. And I'm looking at it and I know that we need more lights. And so I ended up finding this company that does Christmas lights normally, like every year. And since we weren't filming around Christmas, because, we do that, we shoot around different times of the year. And I offered him a certain amount of money, which was less than he normally makes, but it was just really fast work. It's like outlining houses and doing silly things with lights. But I had to check with our union first, the local union that we were working in the city with. And I was like, hey, it's not so much that we need to hire more guys to do this. It's more of like a safety thing because there's snow, there's ice, the temperatures aren't really the best to work in. So if you're pulling a 12-hour day in these temperatures, it's just not as safe as it could be. And we have this time frame. So it'll be better just to hire this company and they'll knock it out in 3 hours.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So the company came, knocked it out in 3 hours, saved my guys a bunch of work, and we all got to stay in warm state for a little bit longer.
And I think it's sometimes hard to explain that to production.
Yeah.
I think when people are behind their desks looking at paperwork and they're like, gosh, this company cost us a lot of money.
Right.
And we already have a whole team of set dressers,
Very different.
They don't put two and two together. They don't understand that you've only given them 3 days, that not only that, but the weather conditions are impossible.
Right.
It's like, I almost wish a lot of times that production could experience these very niche situations we get put into.
Oh, absolutely. I had to have a special meeting with the UPM and the producer and just be like, hey, this is why I'm approaching it in this way. And they didn't fully get it because they're not on the lift that has to drive down a certain level of grades. And then there's ice involved. And then they're on these roofs stapling, not stapling even, because we had to have it non-permanently attached to all these houses because that was the location agreement that locations made.
Yeah.
So it was like so many factors that just, they build on each other. And sometimes you're just put in that position where it's like, we're just here to solve the problem. So like, how do we solve it?
What's the fastest way that we can get it done?
Exactly. That was Sally Ledger, and she did an amazing job with her interview and just kind of elaborating on some of the things that I wasn't even familiar with in the art department, just because I work closely with them, but I haven't ever worked as an art director. So it was really exciting to hear her insight, and especially her background, just because she's lived in multiple countries and she's traveled around and she's moved around. And it's always fun to hear how people got started in the industry for me personally. So I hope you guys enjoyed it. And a couple of things that I am going to mention. We have an Instagram, and if you are Instagram friendly, you should join us on the Gopher Set Deck podcast page, because we love friends and a good follow does well for many, many of us over here on this lone island of Set Deck. Another thing is we have a Patreon page in case you feel so inclined to give us your money. We would like that. It's Gopher Set Deck podcast at Patreon. And on top of that, free things, very free things that you can do to help us are listening, number one. So thank you so much. It's very nice of you. And number two is to rate, review, subscribe. All three of those things, super duper helpful. It helps us reach new audiences. It does things with charts and sciences of algorithms and things. So that would be pretty cool if you could do that. And I just also appreciate the interactions. So I'm gonna say that. And thank you, Melissa, for writing over in our Instagram messaging. It was great to hear from you, and I really appreciate your kind words. So thank you. And lastly, we have an email in case you need to contact us for anything. I keep saying us. It's just me. But it feels weird to claim everything for myself. So I'm just going to keep saying us. And I have an editor, and I appreciate all of their work that they do on this podcast, because I make some mistakes and make some very awkward things that you guys don't have to hear because they cut it out. So anyways, gophersetdeckpodcast@gmail.com is the email address if you feel any kind of interest in talking to us or suggesting some topics that you would love to hear about, or just saying hi. I like to say hi. Hi is fun. And yeah, the ad that plays at the beginning of this episode is a way for me to find sponsorship. So thanks for struggling it through it. That's how you say that, I think. All right, I'm going to sign off and eat some food because apparently my brain needs nourishment. Thank you so much for listening, and be a fucking exceptional human. Today, tomorrow, every day, all the days. Goodbye.